Welcome to SCOTUS Cast. On June 12th, the Supreme Court decided Bomadine v. Bush. The court held that certain detainees currently being held at the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base in Cuba have a constitutional right to challenge their detention by filing habeas corpus writs, and that the alternative remedy provided by Congress was not an adequate substitute. On the same day, in Muniz v. Guerin, the court held that the habeas statute confers jurisdiction on federal district courts to consider the habeas petitions of U.S. citizens asserted to have committed crimes in Iraq and detained by U.S.-led coalition forces in Iraq, pending a transfer to Iraqi authorities for trial or further proceedings following a vacated conviction in an Iraqi criminal court, but that the writ could not be invoked for the transfer of the detainees to Iraqi authorities, and hence should have been properly dismissed on the merits. University of Chicago law professor Richard Epstein discusses the cases. In another episode of SCOTUS Cast, David Rivkin offers a different view of Bomadine. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Epstein.
Yesterday, June 12th, 2008, was a very important day with respect to the status of the writ of habeas corpus in the United States. My name is Richard Epstein. I was involved in one of these cases, the Bomadine case against President Bush. Was not involved in the other Muniz case against Guerin, who was the Secretary for the Army. But let's back up and treat something about them because they're extremely important for the way in which we understand the relationship of American power with respect to both citizens and non-citizens who are under our control. The more dramatic of the two cases is surely Bomadine v. Bush, and it involved the situation in which it turned out the United States captured various individuals whom it labeled as enemy combatants overseas, including places like Afghanistan. And the question is, once they returned to Guantanamo Bay, what was to be done with them? The original effort was to sort of keep them locked up almost indefinitely without legal recourse, and in the earlier decision of Rasool and Bush, it was held that habeas corpus as defined under statute was available to these people to challenge their detention. The Congress and the President of the United States did not take kindly to that decision. And so in 2006, they passed the Military Commissions Act, which essentially says that the federal courts are going to be stripped of habeas corpus with respect to anything that involves any aspect of the detention, transfer, treatment, trial or conditions of confinement of any individual who happens to be in custody. And all of these individuals would be remitted to the operations of a combat status review tribunal, which was done solely inside the military, with only very, very limited rights to get into the court system once a judgment adverse to them had taken place. And the question is whether or not this kind of maneuver was going to withstand the constitutional challenges which were sure to follow. And the answer in the Bomadine case was no. They had fallen short on a whole variety of situations. And the first of the two questions that one has to ask about this situation is whether or not the suspension of the writ of habeas corpus, which can only be done in times of war or insurrection, is in fact a protection which applies to these individuals. And it's a question which is perhaps a little bit more complicated than might appear at first blush. And there were a couple of grounds on which the United States argued that this did not apply. And essentially they said, look, the position with respect to habeas corpus is as follows. The writ is available to any individual who is within the territory of the United States, whether a citizen or non-citizen, and it's available to any citizen of the United States, whether or not within the territory of the United States. But anyone who is a non-citizen and who is not in the territory of the United States cannot get the benefit of the writ. The government then continued to say that Guantanamo is under a long-term lease from Cuba, and so therefore it does not count as territory of the United States, and that Bomadine and others were in fact non-citizens, and so therefore they fell within the rule in a case called Eisentrager versus Johnson, where in effect it was decided that non-citizens held overseas were in fact outside the jurisdiction of the habeas corpus writ. And the Supreme Court essentially rejected this argument by a narrow 5-4 vote. And this was a situation in which Justice Kennedy was the swing vote, voted with the four liberals, and the four conservatives, Scalia, Thomas, Roberts, and Alito, were on the other side. I should say that I thought the decision of the court was right, and I say so as a friend of limited government, not as a friend of terrorists, in any way, shape, or form. How is it that one would want to reach this conclusion? Well, the narrow ground on which to reach it, I think, is to say that Guantanamo is, in fact, really part of the United States for these purposes, given the fact that we exercise unfettered control over the territory. And so they're trying to treat it like Germany, which was the situation in Eisenträger, would be a mistake by way of analogy. I actually am not particularly fond of that argument one way or another. I think the correct way to do this is to say that Eisenträger was, in fact, wrong, that individuals who were not citizens of the United States and were held by the United States in custody outside the territory of the United States are, in fact, entitled to habeas corpus. There's nothing about the language of the suspension clause, nothing about the history of the suspension clause, which says that either citizenship or territory ought to be appropriate. Supreme Court didn't take that line. Rather, what it did was to fudge a bit and to argue that Eisenträger worried about these two things, and then they injected a third element about the institutional and practical difficulties and said, aha, that's why they denied our friend Eisenträger his jurisdiction in the United States. Wouldn't happen in Guantanamo, where we have much more secure control over the situation than we had in Germany during the occupation. That seemed to me to be fairly fanciful on the part of the majority of the Supreme Court, and I think that dissent was clearly right to excoriate them for playing fast and loose with the precedent. But that doesn't answer the fundamental question of why it is that habeas itself cannot be granted. Now, the second issue is once we decide that habeas corpus lies, what kinds of procedures are involved? And the standard under habeas was to allow people to go into court to challenge their detention before an independent judge, using the full panoply of procedural rights. The Combat Status Review Tribunals short-circuit all of this. What they do, in effect, is they have a truncated trial, and they have very weak kind of judicial review. There's no hearing. There's no way to present witnesses or evidence. Sometimes there's no way to confront evidences. And, in fact, if you went through a list of all of the hallmark protections in terms of notice, hearing, opportunity to cross-examine, and so forth, that are normally considered to be part of due process, each and every one of them was absent with respect to the status of these tribunals. So the Supreme Court, taking a cautious view, says, we don't tell you exactly what you have to decide, but we know that all of this stuff turns out to be woefully deficient, and it seems to me that they are right on that. The simplest thing is to give a standard trial in civil court, only to determine the question of whether or not somebody is an enemy combatant. If an enemy combatant, then in effect they go back into the dungeon. If not, then they have to have a criminal trial or be released. Seems to me to be the right result. And I think that Justice Scalia in particular went a little bit over the top when he said that this decision will turn out to be a complete disaster. The dangers that we face in Iraq are handled best by surges and military responses. All the stuff that goes on in Guantanamo has a small amount to do with what's happening there. But it seems to me that one could convict people if the evidence is this good and the procedures internal to the military were as sound as he said. So I think, in effect, that decision was right. The second case that one has to talk about, the Muniff versus Guerin being the Secretary of the Army, is a much sadder tale. This is a situation which involves a multinational force in Iraq. And what had happened is that they took custody of two Americans, Shaqui Omar and Mohammed Munaf, who were allegedly charged with committing various kinds of criminal activities in Iraq, punishable, I might add, by death. And the question is whether or not they were entitled to habeas corpus in order to challenge the legality of their detention. And what these two men were interested in was not just challenging the legality of the detention, but making sure that they were not turned over to the Iraqi authorities, which they would have been if the United States multi-military force had simply released them. The Iraqis could have arrested them and punished them with death, if appropriate, under Iraqi law. And there are two issues in this particular case. The first is the question of whether or not we decide that habeas corpus is appropriate. And I regard this as a relatively trivial question. These are citizens of the United States. They were held in custody by American troops. There was some learned dispute as to whether or not these were American troops acting in an American capacity answerable to the President of the United States, or whether they were holding him in custody only as part of an international force. The Supreme Court resolved that by saying, in effect, that these were American troops under American command, and so therefore, since they were citizens, habeas lay. The question is, what happens when it lies? And here's where the tale gets very sad. If you go back and you look at the various kinds of treaties which allow us to place our troops in foreign lands, it turns out that we have recognized that foreign governments have all-powerful sovereignty with respect to criminal offenses committed within their territories. The treaties are really quite strong and pretty unambiguous, and international relationships are not the place to introduce modern techniques of deconstruction in order to allow you to get your way. And so all nine justices of the Supreme Court essentially said there's nothing we can do. Our hands are tied. These individuals must be turned over to the Iraqi authorities. They cannot be released. They cannot be sent back to the United States and tried here for the offenses that they commit there. And I think there's a kind of a long and sad lesson in all of this. Much of American modern constitutionalism rests, in my view, on the misguided view that every text is ambiguous, so the only thing we worry about is whether or not there's some institutional response this way or that. And so we have our minimalists and our maximists and our activists and our Burkeans and our strict textualists and so forth. I think, in effect, language is much less of a barrier if you're only willing to follow unpleasant results. And what's so touching and so sad about Munah is it seemed to me that the language was clear, the results leave people very uneasy, but to the extent that you're involved in international relations, you do not want courts welching on agreements in ways that will make it impossible for the executive to cut their business. And that's not true with respect to the situation in Boudabin. The government and the Justice Department will figure out how to proceed with these cases, and whatever's going to happen in Iraq will be determined by larger political forces and not by the outcome in Guantanamo Bay. Richard Epstein at the University of Chicago, finishing his podcast. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video from past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.